This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 3rd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 407. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the Big Deal feature, it is British Columbia Day weekend, a time to enjoy the parks, forests, mountains, lakes, and rivers of BC, where 95% of the land is owned by the province. A new group, the Public Land Use Society, is concerned about the NDP government making secret deals with First Nations to cut public access to public land. My guest is Public Land Use Society Executive Director Warren Murko. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It is British Columbia Day weekend, time to get out and enjoy the land by hiking, climbing, biking, camping, swimming, or just relaxing. 95% of British Columbia is Crown land. It's a resource owned by the people of BC. But much of that land is also claimed by First Nations, who never gave up the land when settlers came in the 19th century. The province and federal government opened the BC Treaty Commission in 1992 to try to settle land claims and encourage self-government. Fast forward to 2025, it has produced only 7 modern treaties. In 2019, Premier John Horgan adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It was sold to British Columbians as a step forward for reconciliation. His successor, Premier David Eby, tried to take it one step further before the 2024 election, but he pushed pause after a public outcry about a plan to co-manage land with First Nations. Eby's Plan B? Piece-by-piece accords on Haida Gwaii, Sea to Sky, and Nanaimo, with more to come. A group that has popped up to ask questions about where this is all going and perhaps even offer some alternatives is the Public Land Use Society. And joining me on this podcast this week from the Public Land Use Society is Warren Murko, the Executive Director. Warren, first of all, what is the Public Land Use Society and who is involved?
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me. And yeah, I'm happy to speak about our group. The acronym sounds not bad. It's PLUS. So I'll refer to our group, the Public Land Use Society, as that. PLUS started just a couple months ago, maybe 4 months now, in response to last year's Land Act amendments, which were proposed by the government of BC, and then after public outrage were subsequently withdrawn. What I saw at the time was that only public outrage to those proposals, which came forth in the media, not through government announcements, was a big issue because the government was going to move ahead without a lot of transparency, making sweeping changes in the province without any input from the public. And if they were to try that last year, they could try it again. So I thought over the holidays, Christmas holidays and into the new year, we should prepare for some kind of similar initiative. And I started PLUS launching a website, I think back in March or April. And lo and behold, the Land Act amendments seem to be back under a new template of provincial land use planning agreements. Those are still happening without any public input. They have legal teeth, as it's argued, giving veto power to First Nations in the province through agreements, land use agreements made with different groups. And this veto power is something, like you mentioned last year, that the province and the minister responsible at the time, Nathan Cullen, promised he would not implement, and that this was dog whistle communications by opponents, that there was no veto, but that's clearly not the case with what's unfolding now. And so PLUS finds itself getting a lot of feedback from the public online and through email and through connections in our network with concern from people about land use planning agreements and how it impacts them.
What concerns you about the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples and how that is being implemented into the government today?
Looking at some of the articles that our team has written and published in the media, those articles really speak to what we're seeing unfold on a case-by-case basis. And I'll use the example of Joffre Lakes, which most people are familiar with. But really any example where the province is cloaking its engagement with First Nations around the principles of UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and the provincial version of it, which they've put into law in British Columbia, which we call DRIPA. And what we found is that through those principles and that ideological commitment to UNDRIP, the province is willing to make deals with different groups in the province, and those include land use deals. But it also includes allowing First Nation groups to unilaterally claim territory that they will say is their traditional territory, and do things like shut down a park, in this case, Joffre Lakes, or a string of other parks this summer, for different reasons. And the province might not agree with them on the closure or the length of time, but they will stand by and enforce those decisions, because these groups are making the claim that any decision made on asserted territory requires their free, prior, and informed consent. And that's a principle in DRIPA that seems to be at odds with Canadian constitutional law and the rights provided to Aboriginal peoples under Section 35 of the Constitution. So we have a little bit of a legal and complex discrepancy going on here, but that incompatibility is something that we're seeing play out right now through the summer in British Columbia. Is how can you reconcile, for example, giving Squamish Nation or other Indigenous groups executive authority or exclusive decision-making authority over asserted territory that includes public land or crown land. And that's now been extended to provincial parks and recreation sites. How that's squared away or where the province derives the authority to give these groups who have no democratic relationship with the public or sometimes with the government, where they derive the authority to do that remains a question that I don't think there's a clear answer to.
They're putting everything on the UNDRIP, on the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. That's their priority. Their priority has not been to solve the treaty question. Do you think that's a mistake? Should the BC Treaty Commission be the vehicle?
That's really a tough question, and sometimes or in most likelihood beyond my purview or expertise to answer. But I do think the Treaty Commission and the process for negotiating treaties is going to be drawn out and difficult given what's at stake. And it's an evidence-based legal test where you have to be able to prove through written, oral, and other history and examples, occupation of land through a legal system. So I don't think that it's ever meant to be easy or something that should be expedited. That's sort of the issue that PLUS and many groups have with DRIPA and with these land use agreements that are coming out this summer, is territory that is claimed or asserted is being given to some nations with exclusive authority over that entire territory without ownership or historical presence being proven through the Treaty Commission or title through the courts. There are title agreements where that have been made, and there's asserted territory that extends beyond those title agreements. And in some cases, nations are getting control or co-management authority with the government over territory that is in addition to their title territory. There's no public input whatsoever into these agreements. There's no awareness until agreements are signed and press released, if at all. And in the case of the Squamish Nation agreement, that was issued before the Canada Day long weekend, which was convenient and difficult for media to report on or for us to get an article out about. And I think that that's a big shame, is that people should be made aware of these negotiations, the Crown land and access restrictions that might result, and even the private property impacts within red circled areas of different tiered authority that nations can have over Crown land or private land in the province.
The day after the province and the Squamish Nation announced a 20,000-hectare deal, David Eby signed a memorandum of understanding with the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh about FIFA World Cup 26 benefits.
Do you think that there's some of that at play, that the NDP is hurrying up to do some of these deals so that it can tell the world media when it comes next year that, we're well on our way to reconciliation. We're solving all the problems.
It's certainly hard to ascribe motivation given the lack of transparency, right? It's difficult to understand sometimes or know what's motivating such rapid movements. But I think you're on the point there that these decisions are coming fast, a lot faster than I think were expected, given what the province said last year, that Land Act amendments would not be proceeding, that the government needed to do a better job of engaging the public and ensure that it had the public's trust. And I certainly don't see that here with these agreements, but nevertheless, they're proceeding in rapid motion. And it would seem to be to the benefit of the province in order to be able to close as many deals as they can. And if it's for before FIFA or any other target that they have, it's hard to know for certain. But I think we can expect more deals throughout the summer and the autumn with little or no notice to when they're announced and no chance for input.
And shortly after the deal with the Squamish Nation for about 20,000 hectares in its traditional territory, there was the announcement of about 700 hectares around Mount Benson North in the Nanaimo area to the Nanaimo First Nation. So they do seem to be happening in rapid succession. No, two of these agreements are really the same.
An article out yesterday in the Northern Beat by a veteran journalist that speaks at length about this, that all of these deals are a little bit separate, but with the legal teeth to give exclusive decision-making authority or a veto to First Nations. And it can be a bit complex to assess each deal, and then maybe that's because they're not under the Land Act and the proposed amendments that were put forward last year. They're all done in negotiation behind the scenes without any public input. So as they're released, we have to wade through each agreement. The Squamish agreement, for example, was over 90 pages long with 50 maps and a very small press release. And even within that release, the statements by the Squamish Nation sometimes don't reflect what's in the agreement itself. The Squamish Nation were quoted as saying, "These lands are now finally back under our control." But there were four different sort of control measures within the agreement. So how much control is being given is not always clear. And some of these deals are still being negotiated after the press release. It's really quite confusing and concerning just how much is going on that impacts more than Crown land, right? It's more than the rec sites or the named parks that we're all familiar with, but it's parts of BC that you might not have been to before, but you might want to go to, like up north. The top third of the province is now covered under a new agreement. There could be restrictions to access for recreation. There's a moratorium on mineral claims being staked. Impacts for oil and gas and forestry and other industries. We don't know what the outcomes are going to be of this. There's expedited engagement sessions with the public, if they exist at all. And really, land use planning is not meant to happen to this scale with this limited amount of public input and this rush. It's really confounding to see what's happening and to compare it against what we were told last year by the premier and the then minister responsible for all of this.
One of the flashpoints in British Columbia is the Joffre Lakes Provincial Park. A picturesque provincial park east of Pemberton is famous for glacier-fed lakes splashed all over social media. BC Parks and the Lilwat and the Nkwakwa peoples have agreed to close public access from August 22nd to October 23rd. When it is open, there's a new system of day passes to limit the amount of visitors. Joffre Lakes is a victim of over-tourism. Too many people all at once, it seems. So I asked Warren Murko from the Public Land Use Society whether the closures are justified to protect the resource.
First thought and clarification is that access is restricted right now based on what seems to be ancestry or ethnicity. It has nothing to do with the number of people visiting that site. It's purely on ethnicity. And I think that that's wrong. There should not be two classes of people who can access public land funded by the public, that any one or two groups has no authority to shut down access, as they say. Shutting down access to that crown land is wrong. It needs to be opened up. And as of right now, nobody knows how long that park is going to be shut down, because it's a unilateral closure that the province does not agree with. And by extension, my view is the province has lost support, or rather control of parks in British Columbia. By allowing that to happen, it could happen anywhere. Speaking of Joffre Lake specifically, the numbers did become unsustainable up to the pandemic. The number of hikers who were in there had been increasing year over year. Parking lots were full. I think we all saw a lot of stories coming out about it. But I would note that the numbers had been declining for 4 to 5 years, year over year, until it was shut down. So the numbers were at their 5-year low and things were getting better. And that was because restrictions were put in place during the pandemic, and then they stayed on for that site. So there are ways to lower the number of visitors to any park. That's like we did with our camping system, by issuing day passes, enforcing access to those critical areas. And I think that we need to think about compliance anywhere in the province, hire more conservation officers, provincial and federal, to ensure that our lands are protected from those who would abuse it, from any background. Garbage, poaching, pollution, off-road vehicle use where it's not allowed. There's a million things that can go wrong that we need to ensure are caught and punished. We can do that effectively every day, all throughout the province. And we could have been continuing to do that at Joffre Lakes. But instead, we see that unilateral shutdown for what's claimed to be 100 days after what was just a couple dozen days. And we don't know how long it'll be shut down. We don't know if it will ever reopen as of right now, or what park is next in the province to be shut down.
What are you hoping that the Public Land Use Society can achieve in the next year? Where do you see the society going with its campaign?
Yeah, well, with how fast things are moving, it's pretty crazy to think where we are now versus just a couple months ago. But Public Land Use Society is really working on a couple things. One is going to be better public awareness and education of the rights and privilege of access to crown land that all British Columbians have. And I appreciate most people don't know what they can do on crown land. And they might not know about their rights or care about it today, but anyone who wants to have kids or travel around the province, especially during our elbows up time here with issues with our neighbor down south, there's more travel in BC. There's more of a push to explore our own backyard and enjoy nature, get out of being in front of the computer all day. And in order to do that, people need to know what they can do, what their rights are, and where they can do it. So we need to really educate people, I think, especially in the Lower Mainland, about this beautiful privilege of access to crown land in British Columbia that we have. That is something really special to have 95% of the province be protected crown land for public access. What you can do out there, there's no limit to it except the amount of time that we all have. The other thing that we will be working on, in addition to informing and educating people with awareness about that, is building a coalition of other land use groups, both recreational, industry, or community, and bringing them together on a common statement of principle on preserving access to crown land. And that coalition is already forming, with groups signing on with PLUS, which we haven't announced anything yet, where groups with hundreds of thousands of followers, people who go out and enjoy the outdoors for different reasons, we have those groups aligning with us on maintaining and preserving access to crown land. That will be something that we will continue to grow. And through that, I think we'll be able to speak to this government, and that they'll listen, because we will have hundreds of thousands of people who use the land and who are concerned about what's happening today. All British Columbians deserve and have the right to access Crown land in British Columbia. Nobody can take that away. And we need to keep fighting for that and let this government know that some of these land use decisions that restrict our access are wrong.
During this British Columbia Day weekend, where will you be enjoying the beauty of the province?
Yeah, so I moved to the West Kootenays a few years ago to live this exact lifestyle in the outdoors that I now find myself defending. I'll be out fishing, picking huckleberries, out with my kids up at some mountain lakes, and really just enjoying everything I can in every moment while there's sun in the outdoors and appreciating all of it. As we say on our website, and I hear from people now every day throughout the province, the number of uses of Crown land are really massive. People surprise me with how they find their identity and their own culture by using the land. And it inspires me and the team to hear stories from people that we're getting through email now and find out just how much people resonate with having access to Crown land. It's really something special.
Well, thank you for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. Warren Mirko, the Executive Director of the Public Land Use Society. And Warren, where can people find out more about PLUS?
Yeah, anyone can visit our website at publiclanduse.ca. We're also on LinkedIn and Facebook. And happy to hear from people on how they use public land and any access restrictions that they're finding and they want to share with us.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan.tw. Taiwanese urged to better understand China's authoritarianism. Sophie Shengchun Luo, wife of jailed Chinese rights lawyer Ding Jiaqi, said at a press event in Taipei that witnessing the elections firsthand reminded her of how precious and resilient Taiwan's democratic system is. The first wave of the recall campaign, which targeted 24 lawmakers of the main opposition KMT, ended in total failure on July 26th, with none of the recall motions succeeding. A second round of 7 recall votes, also targeting KMT lawmakers, and a referendum on restarting a nuclear power plant is scheduled for August 23rd. In ABC News Australia, Labor says Google sharks will not scare it from banning YouTube for under-16s. YouTube will be included in the list of platforms forced to bar users under the age of 16 from having accounts under the government's world-leading social media ban. The Prime Minister says the government will not be intimidated by Google's threats to sue over YouTube's inclusion. YouTube Kids is expected to be spared from the new laws because it does not allow users to communicate with others through the platform. In Kyoto News, Japan court awards ex-mayor damages over Fukushima nuclear disaster. A Japanese court ordered Tokyo Electric Power Company Holdings, Inc. to pay around $676,000 U.S. in damages to a former town mayor forced to evacuate due to the 2011 crisis at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Katsutaka Itagawa, 79, had sued the state and utility due to the upheaval to his life caused by the forced evacuation. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Oregon Department of Corrections pledges to overhaul prison health care. The pledge comes after years of mismanagement in the unit that bred a toxic work atmosphere among medical providers and substandard care for inmates suffering from ailments of all kinds, from asthma to genital herpes, cancer to traumatic head injuries. In February, the state hired the Falcon Group, a consulting firm that specializes in corrections healthcare, to complete a comprehensive review of the agency's delivery system, including policies, practices, and the quality of care. In Crosscut, 14 rural Washington hospitals deemed at risk of closure from Medicaid cuts. As hundreds of thousands of Washingtonians face potentially losing health coverage, hospital officials race to prevent service cuts and closures. Earlier this month, President Trump signed the bill, also known as the House Resolution 1, which is expected to cut Medicaid by $911 billion. The cuts would be implemented over the next decade. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Exclusive,
5 weeks before by-election, Vancouver City Council secretly okayed deal to explore new Whitecaps Stadium. And, exclusive, documents bring FIFA World Cup 26 road closures into focus. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people that grow, deliver, cook, and sell food in BC. From farms to tables. Food Day in Canada was August 2nd, but it should be every day. Look up your local food bank. They can always use your help. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 3rd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 3rd of August in 1936, American Jesse Owens won the 100-meter race at the Berlin Olympics, and in 1949, on August 3rd, the Basketball Association of America merged with the National Basketball League to become the NBA. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News on X, formerly Twitter, for news as it happens. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.